This is Polling Matters in association with politicalbetting.com. My name is Kieran Pedley. Today we're going to be talking about the Conservatives. With all the talk about Labour and Jeremy Corbyn's surprise victory in the leadership contest, it's easy to forget just what a good year it's been for the Tories. Having seemingly faced defeat of some kind in May, they emerged with a shock election victory and a majority government. And now David Cameron and his party seem unstoppable. And some commentators are suggesting that they may even face a decade in power or more. But are things all as they seem? Are the Tories as strong as we think? Or could the EU referendum, Cameron standing down and other events that we may not yet know about mean that their situation is not quite as good as we think it is? I'm joined today by Asa Bennett from The Telegraph and my fellow podcaster Rob Vance to discuss these issues and more. Gentlemen, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Asa, as a journalist, if you're to believe the stories that we saw on social media and in the news, it was probably not a very good and pleasant experience being a journalist at Tory Party conference. How did you find it?
It was quite tough. Certainly, having people shout at you in your face that you're a murderer.
So they were actually doing that to you, as we saw.
Almost there was one chap one afternoon on a Tuesday. It was a sort of grey Manchester who would ask every single person, including me, how many kids have you killed today? And it was all very odd. He's like a troll personified in a sense, because you couldn't win. You have to just shrug it off and move on. And ironically, I would say that was a reason why the Tory conference, the attendees, they were in much better mood and not really fighting so much, because they thought after being called all sorts of things and with that vitriol, you know, why bother arguing about the EU and all the rest, you know, when you've got the enemy outside?
It's almost solidarity against the protesters, isn't it?
Old style politics.
I mean, Rob, it doesn't feel like a good impression was left of the left, or maybe even the Labour Party by proxy, with some of those scenes. I mean, what did you make of some of that?
Well, I mean, I think it's sad, isn't it? I mean, I think it'd be wrong, and correct me if I'm, you know, getting the wrong end of the stick here, but it's a minority of a minority of a minority, right? In terms of a minority who remain as Labour supporters, a smaller minority of that who are even, you know, on the demonstration, and then evidently a lingering and fairly poisonous bunch who are there. I mean, I'm curious as to whether it was, in a sense, more just it being Tory conference, or whether it was specifically, you know, being singled out as being part of the media, the commentariat, and so on. You know, was there a differentiation there? I mean, did you have an obvious press pass?
Well, no.
I was just wondering. I mean, whether they were spotting press pass and things like that.
They weren't.
Just everybody,
I would say,
you know, anybody in a suit.
In that, people sort of. I was once called scumbag. I said I'm a journalist. They said, no, you're a journalist, scumbag. Then, so they were just still wanting to throw things at you anyway. I believe Owen Jones, the Guardian columnist, he was called a Tory scumbag as well, which was a surprise for him. He had to turn around and they said, sorry, Owen.
Almost that sort of heartening, it's sort of undiscriminating poisonous, right?
Some of these people seem to be sort of professional anarchists in that they were just there to have a laugh and call people silly things. And admittedly then, some Tory ministers were quite disgusted by this. I think Anna Soubry had heard all sorts of unsavoury words.
There was a rape threat, apparently,
yes,
wasn't
some
there?
Yes, activist.
Something like that.
It's a really horrible anti-Semitic stuff as
and,
well.
And some trouble is, of course, that the police then were having to be an awkward balance to strike, because I suppose the sight on the cameras of, you know, police, you know, giving old police brutality and repressing people, that wouldn't look very good for the government of the day. And so I think these activists knew this, though, so they could try and be right up in people's faces and really put that case and sort of scream, you know, bloody murder.
But was there an actual agenda at any point in this? I mean, there's sort of, you know, we've seen, you know, the how many kids have you killed today is LBJ in the 60s over the Vietnam War. And obviously there were protests at Labour Party conferences over Iraq and over, I think, even the Countryside Alliance in one year in Brighton. You know, we've seen big protests outside, but they tend to be motivated by issues. I mean, were there issues that they were sort of bringing up, or was it just literally, as you sort of say, kind of an anarchic...
Well,
you
it
know,
was all sorts.
Just against the government and particularly a Tory government.
I would say the one thing I would just interject there, but one thing I'm surprised about is, I guess this must have been organised to some extent, right? And what I'm surprised about is that at no point during the Tory conference did anybody that was organising say, come on guys, it's probably not a good look for us to be hanging out by the door screaming abuse at people, maybe we should not do that. But maybe it wasn't that organised.
Well, they would say they were taking their case right up to the Tories and, you know, welcoming them to Manchester. I think the phrase on Twitter was, take back Manchester. And so it was a big umbrella of anti-Tory anger, but I suppose energised by the fact that David Cameron obviously won a majority and surprised everyone, as he told everyone in his keynote speech. And so given this kind of inevitable glee the Tories were going to have, I suppose the protesters thought, right, you know, this is where we get right up in their faces and tell them what we think. And so it kind of attracted a sort of a potpourri of causes as people wanted to protest about things like, you know, welfare cuts, particularly tax credits and the changes that will happen there, and otherwise just lots of odd posters about Ian Duncan Smith and all sorts of things being thrown around.
And I suppose
means-tested negative income taxes.
I suppose Rob won't talk about Labour too much today, I don't think, but briefly, I suppose. Normally, Labour leaders would want to sort of very actively distance themselves from that sort of behaviour. I mean, is there a risk that Jeremy Corbyn, in speaking, and Jeremy Corbyn, to be clear, was very adamant that, you know, there should be civil debate and that there shouldn't be name calling, and he's been very, very open and transparent about that. But I suppose in speaking at the very impressive event that he spoke at, maybe in some people's minds they might associate him with the rabble, in inverted commas.
I think it's unfortunate, and I'm not quite sure what the answer is, because I think in previous years nobody would have ever suggested that Gordon Brown or Tony Blair needed to differentiate themselves from left-wing activists who might have gone to speeches by Conservative, you know, leaders of the opposition or whatever else it is. You know, it's so there's a sort of slight double standards in terms of, well, why should he do that? Is it, you know, in the sense, would it not be better for him to sort of rise above the fray and have absolutely nothing to do with it? I don't really believe that going and speaking at a completely peaceful rally organised by the TUC, you know, is in any way kind of a reason for legitimising it. But at the same time, there is this nagging question, and at some point, I don't know what the leadership and Corbyn and so on do about it, because at some point you have to sort of put that clear water there and put yourself back on the side of, you know, we don't believe in, you know, we believe in winning power at the ballot box rather than in the streets and so on. You know, something which, ironically enough, you know, the TUC more or less conceded after the general strike. But, you know, still they do, you know, these protests. But there is a big difference
between... John McDonnell's got ambiguous rhetoric on this, hasn't he, though?
Well, I think he... Probably more so than Corbyn. But I think if you were to go back through sort of the Corbyn files at various points in time, he's called for direct action, which, again, is a totally legitimate form of protest, particularly on single issues. You know, a huge, great history of, you know, I think Zach Goldsmith would probably be supportive of, you know, the things that were done in the 70s and 80s by groups like Friends of the Earth and so on. You know, I think we need to make a really clear distinction here between legitimate organised protest, direct action, you know, absolutely within the law, and the kind of, you know, baying, you know. And I think generally not, I doubt very much, Labour Party members actually, you know, standing outside there spitting at journalists, giving anti-Semitic comments and abuse to people and making, you know, you know, disgusting threats. I just think the issue is at some point Corbyn has to take it head on, and he did so in a sort of personal capacity in terms of saying, I don't believe in doing personal attacks, which meant that he didn't go after Cameron's speech in terms of the attacks on him, and he's trying to rise above the fray. But I think he's going to keep on getting dragged in by association unless he comes up with a strategy that can come put some...
I mean, let's go back to the Tories and start with the Prime Minister. I mean, it's been a great year for David Cameron, obviously. I think it's fair to say one of the key assets that the Conservatives had in the general election was his personal lead in poll ratings over Ed Miliband. That isn't going to change, it doesn't look like, with Jeremy Corbyn either. I mean, Asa, given the reception of his speech, which generally seemed to be received positively too, it's, you know, David Cameron's in quite a good place at the moment, isn't he?
What's
your perceptions of his conference?
I think he definitely showed that in his performance on the conference stage, because he felt able to challenge his party with things that wouldn't be comfortable for a normally right-wing audience. He spoke about things like inequality and social mobility, and he challenged them to sort of improve the state of society. And of course, there's normally the sort of right-wing orthodoxy that says that, hang on, you shouldn't be doing this because that's tinkering with markets and it's, you know, setting things up and slanting things in different people's favours. And yet he was saying that, you know, he has two daughters and he wants them to succeed on their own merits and be paid as much as men, and all these sort of things that people then ended up saying, oh, this sounds quite left-wing. But equally, I think it's a matter of delivery by results, because he's said now he's got 5 years. He's made very clear that he is leaving in 2020, and not having that third bowl of shredded wheat, as he infamously said during the election. And so it depends. He's set a lot of ambitious aims, including a national crusade on house building. And so we have to see what happens.
Yeah. And presumably, actually, I mean, it's worth remembering that he had such a problem in the last parliament with some of his MPs defecting to UKIP and a lot of grumbling that he didn't win in 2010. I mean, presumably, it would be logical to imagine that his victory in 2015 and now having been shown to be a winner means that he's viewed very differently in his own party.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, last year, wasn't it that there was a sort of paranoia at Conservative conference about who might defect next? And there was all this farrago about Nigel Farage, about to unveil possibly a third defector. You know, rumours were rife, and no, it was just a massive cheque from a donor, because William Hague said this donor was a nobody. And so it was a bit of an anticlimax there. And now you find that Cameron is triumphant, and UKIP had its bout of chaos after the election, as did Labour and the Liberal Democrats. And so he was justified in being able to have a sort of victory lap.
I mean, Rob, I mean, one of the things that, Dan Hodges tweeted some slightly provocative things earlier in the week about...
There's a first.
Shocking, isn't it? About how David Cameron was now the leader of the centre-left, I think was one of them. But there is a serious point, I suppose, in David Cameron's positioning is clearly to try and sort of be in the inverted commas centre ground and to try and park his tank on Labour's lawn or whatever metaphor you want to use. I mean, what's your perception of that? Because I guess clearly that's a danger for Labour if they are perceived to have vacated that space and then the Tories can plant themselves there with the sort of boundary changes too. But then also, presumably, there's two challenges. One is about does the rhetoric match the action? And also, is moving to the centre going to create space for a challenge on the right within his own party? I mean, what's your take on David Cameron's position this week?
So I think the first thing to note is that it's not just Cameron's positioning. So I get that Cameron, you know, is the leader of the party and so on, but it's clear that there are several other people within the party who are making similar manoeuvres, potentially for their own political ends rather than necessarily for the ends, as it were, purely of the party. And most notable in this is Boris Johnson with the anti-tax or supposedly anti sort of trying to reform the tax credit proposals that's going through. And on the flip side, Osborne with, you know, various manoeuvres, you know, talking, you know, well, he's always gone on about the Great Northern Powerhouse, but other manoeuvres in terms of, you know, and certainly rhetoric in terms of, you know, being the true workers' party and doing various things to liberate councils, to do things, not least of all house building and planning permission and stuff. But I think, so what's interesting there is a clear coordinated, or at least everybody doing the same thing for their own reasons, effort to portray the party as that. But I think Issa is absolutely right. It's about whether that actually does deliver genuine, you know, as it were, devolution, not of the kind of institutionalised regional kind, but of the kind of, you know, city regions or, you know, empowered, certainly empowered local government, able to make genuine decisions and have autonomy over stuff. Does that does that follow through? Does that lead, or does other initiatives announced lead to, you know, the kind of doubling of house building, which is what most of the commentators seem to think is required in order to maintain stuff. Mm. I mean, it's all very well for Cameron to make these great speeches, and I think you're right in terms of saying some things to the party, which in a sense he could afford to say. It was a kind of a safe space, having, you know, well, not just now that he's leader, but also having demonstrated that in a sense they can believe that his political antenna are correct. Right, having won this election, and also the fact that Osborne's saying that as well, it's not like anybody's about to knife him in the back. Whereas I think it's probably fair to say that in the run up to the last election, there were various points where, you know, you could imagine some kind of challenge to his leadership, which is not going to happen now.
I mean, one of the things I'm interested in picking up on, you mentioned about this idea of accidental coordination of the message that's coming out of some of the leading figures in the Conservative Party. I mean, there was, at least earlier in the week, this idea, this perception that this might be something of an inverted commas, again, beauty contest for the future leadership contenders. Certainly, they all had their own set-piece speeches, didn't they? Theresa May, Boris Johnson, George Osborne, of course. I mean, let's talk a bit about where we think the future sort of leadership sort of dynamic might go. I mean, we had a poll recently last month from Ipsos Mori, which showed that Boris Johnson was the most popular of the assumed leadership candidates among the general public, but amongst Conservative, and he had 27% to May's 17. I think Osborne might have been on 15, but I might have that wrong. And then amongst Conservative voters, Osborne was winning, only slightly ahead of Boris Johnson, but Theresa May was back sort of 10 points behind. So there's this difference there between what the public thinks, and they quite like Boris, but actually Conservative voters might like Osborne a bit more. Presumably it's early days, Asa, but I mean, what's your take on the state of that, the sort of race to succeed Cameron? I mean, everyone talks about Osborne being in the box seat, but then it's a long way to go, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a bit of an endurance contest. As the cliche would go, it's a marathon, not a sprint, because he's already indicated he does not want to go until it's 2019, 2020. And so, obviously, in these sort of 4 years, you've got all sorts of factors that could happen, namely the EU referendum. And there's all sorts of unanswered questions about this. In other words, What does the Chancellor do? Where? What side of the fence does he land? Does he campaign for a deal, let's say it goes very well, or out? And ditto, Boris Johnson, what does he think? Because if, let's say, it's a complete shambles, if the party's an uproar at what the Prime Minister brings back, then suddenly they will look to people who originally said, guys, I was against this the whole time, I wanted us to leave the thing, and they'll say, you were right. Wisdom, the history was on your side. And yet, then the Chancellor will go down with the Cameron ship, if that was the case.
It's interesting. I mean, John Rentoul wrote a piece recently about talking about maybe Boris Johnson might end up, sort of netting out at the leave side. But that feels unlikely, doesn't it? That an Osborne or a Johnson or even a May are going to end up saying they want to leave the European Union. That's a very bold thing to say.
Well, Johnson seems to be toying with it, and that he keeps making these very provocative statements about how awful Brussels is, and yet obviously I am committed for the meantime, and Dave's doing a wonderful job taking on Juncker and all the rest. I mean, the thing that interests me is Theresa May, in that when she gave her speech, she was vitriolic on how, migration, the rate of migration over the last few years has not been conducive to a cohesive society, she said. Yet you think, okay, well, if you're talking about the last decade, who was Home Secretary for the last 5 years? And, every time then she's saying, okay, well, we're going to stick to this migration pledge, which has brought ritual humiliation to the government as it's failed to get it down below 100,000 a year. And then you're thinking, how does she want to do this? What other secret measure does she have waiting in order to finally do this? And could it possibly be, pushing to leave the European Union? Because otherwise,
that's the only way that you would do it. Right?
True, and obviously, for the meantime, it's either that, or she's having to indicate, "Oh, I want some free movement changes." And yet, Philip Hammond has suggested that will not happen. The word he said during the conference was that free movement rules were sacred.
And I suppose, Rob, I mean, Theresa May got quite a lot of negative publicity, it felt, in terms of her speech, and even in some circles that you might traditionally have thought might be sympathetic. I think, I might be wrong, was the Telegraph relatively critical, I think? I can't remember.
One of our columnists, James Kirkup, said it was a bit shabby and was putting leadership interests ahead of anything else.
Sure.
And Dan Hodges said that it was just missing a passage about the blood, Tiber overflowing.
It's not just the Guardian or the Daily Mirror that are criticising this speech, but then are we getting ahead of ourselves? Because if there's one thing we've learned this summer, it's that, it's about the membership that actually chooses the leader, isn't it? So now I know that the Conservative leadership is selected differently to Labour. There will be two candidates. One assumes one of them will be Osborne, or if it's not him, his chosen person, maybe Sajid Javid. But there'll be another person. And I suppose if you're going to be that person that's standing against the status quo, so to speak, better to put clear blue water between you, and maybe she's playing the game she needs to play to win that leadership race.
Yeah, I mean, there's various things that you can imagine being the inspiration for it. One is actually to be, she was giving I don't know whether it was quite right to, the blue meat, if you like, the day before Cameron's much more, as it were, small L liberal speech, but it sounded like in the hall it didn't even go down particularly well amongst, as it were, your sort of true blue grassroots.
Very nervous applause from the audience.
Which is interesting. I mean, this is perhaps a legacy of her own, We Are the Nasty Party thing. People don't feel that comfortable, certainly in a sort of semi-public environment, with sort of quaffing down the kind of particular kind of rhetoric that she was going for.
Just to interject briefly before you carry on, I mean, Paul Goodman mentioned on the Times podcast this week with Tim Montgomery that maybe the Tory Party conference, of the nature of how expensive
sure.
is yeah, necessarily, yeah, necessarily representative of what sure. Their listeners, what,
not,
listeners,
not least,
readers,
not least ever, all the stats that I've ever seen about the average age of the party would sort of certainly not exactly square with the people in the room that day. But I think the other point that I wanted to make was, Oborn in the Telegraph, I think, really interesting piece there, sort of threading this back, as I was saying, to sort of a Euroscepticism and sort of certainly putting yourself on that flank of there's a cleavage in the party that is not as simple as sort of left and right. EU cuts across it in a certain kind of way, as does, the sort of more socially liberal thing. So there's a number of cross currents that you're sort of, she might be edging towards. And ultimately, this is about, it's about coalition building. And, the more and more that George Osborne, looks to occupy, or indeed Boris, who similarly gave an extremely, for his, less humorous, more serious, more explicitly political kind of speech, that leaves a huge swathe of territory for her to occupy, which I think she was doing quite adeptly.
Who do we think is best placed? Because obviously I'm assuming people listening to this will know this already, but if they didn't, the MPs obviously choose two candidates to go forward to the membership. This isn't quite the same free-for-all that Labour have. Who do we think, I mean, if we assume Osborne has it sewn up in terms of getting to, into the top two if he wants to, yes, there's time to go, but we assume that that's reasonable to think will happen.
Well, he spent 5 years building the patronage networks, which, you know, Boris doesn't have access to.
Who do we think of May and Boris has the better sort of organisation within the Conservative? I mean, Asa, you might have a better
I think May is not known for being clubbable. People sort of don't hang around with her in the tea rooms a lot as such. So equally, Boris, though, he's meant to be a bit more of a maverick. He's definitely got supporters who support and like him because they feel he's a winner. And obviously, the Tories are a bit ruthless like that. Mm. So if he does manage to project this image of, you know, dynamism that he did show at the conference, then that could really sustain itself. Whereas I fear that with May, she might sort of come across as if her, you know, her moment has passed, as if you know, there's a new generation who should be given a chance. And Johnson, of course, he of course was written off on the front cover of The Spectator recently, with, I think it was depicting him in the desert, in the wasteland, and saying he was in the wilderness. But obviously he was reminding them now why they loved him in the first place, with all the jokes, and yet it's a serious broad brush vision about what he's done for London, and having a little naughty jab or two at Osborne for stealing City Hall policies, and also mentioning tax credits, of course, which in a sense does kind of sum up the sort of one nation sort of philosophy he's trying to espouse, and almost as a rebranding, because there is a certain nervousness about tax credits in the party, so he's trying to capitalise on that and be ahead of the curve.
And I mean, Rob, I mean, not that polling is going to be the be-all, end-all of this, but I guess Boris's name recognition in the country means that he's probably always going to have a good poll ratings going into that leadership contest as well, insofar as that matters. But it might matter to MPs when they're weighing up who they think they might want to choose.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think particularly because it's going to end up being two candidates, I find it hard to believe that actually when it really comes down to it, there's going to be a big, you know, if it's Osborne plus one other. I think, you know, David Cameron was barely known. If you did a poll about David Cameron in 2003, 2004, you'd have got absolutely, you know, zero. I mean, David Davis was the presumptive favourite all the way, most of the way through the campaign, if I remember rightly, in 2005.
Until that conference speech.
Yeah.
But they were the opposition then, of course, weren't they? So maybe it's a different dynamic in the sense that it's unlikely that some random backbencher is going to become Prime Minister.
Well, obviously, we live in a world where Corbyn has won from 100, was it 100 to 1? That was the beginning.
200 to 1, I think.
Pardon me, yes.
And Cameron was at something like, you know, 20 to 1, 25 to 1 when he first declared. So big changes do happen, and of course, but so I don't think the polling is necessarily going to govern it. But I think, you know, as we saw this summer, you know, the pollsters were actually able to poll the Labour membership reasonably accurately. They didn't do it that often. I suspect
just in the sense the polls will show Johnson is quite popular, and therefore if you're an MP thinking, okay, who do I want to succeed Cameron, then if he's seen as more popular than Osborne, which I think is undoubtedly the case at least at the moment, then, you know, that might
No, it's true. But I think what's going to be quite instructive in that will be the Republican primary, and to a lesser extent the Democratic primary, you know, in the US, where you've now got sort of waves of candidates with zero name recognition, but actually after three or four debates, more it's going to end up being a year-long campaign. You can bet your $1 that people will understand and know who they are. So what will be interesting to see is who comes out of that process, you know, on top, whether the name recognition thing really does matter, or whether actually that suggests that it's worth giving, as it were, the airtime and investing your resources in MP. Because I'm guessing that that sort of the triage that goes on in terms of whittling down the leaders is a fairly complicated one in terms of organising the sort of parliamentary arithmetic in terms of, and this is why I was saying, referencing, you know, Osborne having spent 5 years, you know, building a network of junior ministers, people who've worked in the Treasury, then gone outside of the Treasury, and that continues, parliamentary undersecretaries, working the tea rooms, ensuring that, you know, that everybody knows who he is and that he's done a little bit of something for everybody. That's 5 years head start on Boris. That's quite a big deal. And I think the sort of mechanics of the race mean that that kind of thing is much, much more important in the Conservative Party leadership races than it's ever been in, or than it's been in leadership races since, oh gosh, whenever it would have been, the late 70s, early 80s, when they sort of moved away from that kind of model.
Mm. Osborne definitely is very confident, as we saw in his conference speech. He was talking about the old stuff on tough decisions and difficult choices, and he had a line where he was saying that, you know, people say this is unpopular, but, you know, we're doing it because it's right on the matters of the economy. And of course this might lead him to blunder on tax credits, because he may not listen to advice. He may
a bit like Blair at the end. It was almost a right path.
I have no
badge of honour that he was going to smash through anything he wanted, regardless, almost.
Yeah, obviously, people like David Davis say this could be the poll tax for the Conservatives. So that could be where the error lies.
Well, we were talking about Boris Johnson earlier, so I suppose from one mayor to one potential mayor. I mean, Zach Goldsmith is obviously the nominee for London mayor, mayoral candidate for the Conservatives. He gave a speech as well at the conference, didn't he? I mean, what's your sense, Acer, on his chances? I mean, it feels like to me just, you know, Sadiq Khan, I think, is being a bit underestimated. I think he's probably the favourite, but you know, Zach Goldsmith certainly got more than a small chance of beating him. What do you think?
Yes, I mean, obviously in the conference speech, we expected from the man who romped to victory in the Conservative mayoral selection some really dynamic, inspiring stuff. Yet it was a bit underwhelming. I think he was the conference hall was unkind to him because he slightly rambled on a bit. He seemed a bit unsure of himself, and it wasn't quite the sort of Boris-style bombast that we had come to know from mayors of London. And so in this case, win the race. Obviously, it's interesting because Sadiq and Zach, on each side, they would think that they've got the perfect opponent. Because for Sadiq's team, they'd say they've got a posh old Etonian rich guy who is establishment, and yet Zach's team, they would say they've got a sort of Labour, establishment hack who's worked his way up the ladder, managed to campaign for Ed Miliband, and how could he really represent London then? And so it's really up in the air, I'd say.
I mean, Rob, I mean, it feels to me like there's, I suspect you might agree with me on this, but we'll test it out. It feels to me there's a lot of sort of underestimating of Sadiq Khan, because there's this perception that his victory was largely to do with this Corbyn surge and these new registered members and so on. And if that hadn't have happened, maybe Tessa Jow would have won instead. But he's actually done a very, well, clear to me at least, as a Politico, whether it's clear to the wider Londoners, I'm not sure. He's made a very big point of distancing himself from the leadership and being.
Yeah, I think it's really wrong to creep in with that. I think much safer, though. I think there's obviously enormous differences, to sort of place him much more in the kind of, as it were, Miliband kind of Ed Miliband sort of tradition within the party. He certainly, yeah, I mean, for Tessa, to all intents and purposes, was more from that sort of the Blair or the sort of the more centrist tradition, but he certainly was no hard left, and that is what makes the election so fascinating for me. So we've got it's the first real and only real testbed, I think, in terms of what Corbyn's Labour Party is going to fare like in a real election.
Because of Scotland and local elections in England, they're going to be spinnable, surely.
I mean, so the local elections.
Whereas the mayor is one side wins, one side loses.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was reasonably close last time. London is interesting because, we're starting at a high watermark in terms of, pretty much in the 2015 general election, Labour did, much, much better in London than anywhere else in the country. There's all sorts of demographic trends that make that, reasonably more likely and make London atypical to the rest of the country. But I think, in reality, Scotland is going to, start from such a low base, and actually the local elections similarly start from a reasonably low base, as they were last contested 4 years ago in 2012, which, as we may remember, wasn't a great time either for Labour. London is the testbed. But I think it's fascinating, Zach Goldsmith represents a really interesting kind of reasonably autonomous, in terms of, not necessarily always towing the
leadership line.
Well,
he's never been inside
line.
The tent, has he?
No. He's very much his own man, has a really interesting kind of what you might call sort of movement politics, strong green credentials, a kind of an interesting appeal that is, you could never describe him as anything other than sort of fairly cosmopolitan and a metropolitan and so on. So, definite elements of sort of the Boris's success with, younger voters, small L liberal middle class voters and so on. And then on the flip side, does Sadiq hold together the kind of Ken coalition, which, included a lot of kind of certainly tacit but actually in sometimes explicit support from much more hard left groups, which I guess perhaps now look probably quite like the mainstream Labour Party. But actually, in order to win, he absolutely has to differentiate himself from that. In order to have any chance of winning over the voters that will, swing it for him.
It's going to be a very interesting pivot, isn't it, to motivate the Corbyn base literally in places like Islington and elsewhere, but equally to be palatable to others. I mean, Acer, what do you think the Tories are looking for next May? Because, I mean, clearly Scotland isn't, I mean, well, maybe not. I mean, Ruth Davidson's been sort of well talked up, hasn't she? So maybe the Tories might do better than we think in Scotland.
the English local elections, I suppose, it's usually the governing parties don't do very well in those, but again, let's define well. That's quite difficult in these situations. And we've talked about London. I mean, what's your sense of what the Tories would like to get out of next May? Presumably it's to sort of keep Corbyn hanging on, but in a very wounded way.
Absolutely. So I think they'll be expecting sort of steady progress in Scotland. Nothing remarkable, but something they can really build on. I think what they're most excited about is London, because there's some interesting polling they would point to from YouGov over the last few months, which has pitched Zach versus Sadiq in a face-off. And over the last few months, Zach's lead has increased. It was, as I recall, something like 49-51 in Zach's favour back in sort of June. And over the months to come, it's increased by a few points.
Okay,
and over the, it's definitely some incrementally better for him. So they would be, and by contrast, when they ran this hypothetical scenario with Tessa versus Zach, it was actually flipped round. Tessa won consistently. And so they would be thinking and hoping that London would say Labour has chosen the wrong candidate.
Oh, that's right. I think Servation had a poll that had Sadiq winning, but I think YouGov, you're right, had the sort of flip of Tessa winning versus Zach Goldsmith, but Zach Goldsmith winning versus Sadiq Khan. But I suppose there's lots to play out, Rob, isn't there, between
now and and of course, Sadiq Khan has the ultimate weapon in terms of, you know, being able to run, in a sense, independent of the leadership, in terms of, you know, I'm pretty sure that Jeremy Corbyn at some point in time would have been, you know, on record as supporting Ken Livingstone against the Labour candidate in Frank Dobson back in 2001. So, you know, there's a kind of a track record that, you know, those on the hard left don't really have much of a leg to stand on of Sadiq Khan as the Labour candidate running a very, very independent campaign. But otherwise, it's, you know, because the tragedy would be for it to be a sort of a test bed for Corbynism. You know, I think the likelihood is that Sadiq Khan will run as independent a campaign as he can, and then
George Galloway is going to be interesting there, isn't he? Because George Galloway has a habit of like being quite nasty to the Labour candidate, and actually, if he did that to Sadiq Khan, well, I guess there's a question here: does he do that to Sadiq Khan in the context of Jeremy Corbyn's victory? If he does, presumably that could only help Sadiq Khan look sensible and, normal. And,
well, you'd hope so, wouldn't you?
But, I mean, he wanted to join the Labour Party under Corbyn, and obviously he's been rejected. And so he might... What I'm expecting is he's going to run around saying that he is true Labour, that Sadiq's some sort of fake Labour, the sort of new Labour-ish bland derivative. And so as a result, I think he's just going to be useful as a defining point for Sadiq, because then he can say to voters, I am sensible, unlike this man who used to run Bradford and Tower Hamlets and all sorts of places. And so that's, ironically, I'm thinking going to help him.
Well, I think in one of his by-election campaigns, he used the phrase, God knows who's a true Muslim or something, didn't he?
I insinuated that a rival was drunk and all sorts of nasty things when the 2015 election. He's definitely a sort of dirty fighter.
Anyway, always one to watch in terms of what he does. So, Rob, I mean, you know, all of that considered then, obviously there's some polling out there, there's an intuition. I mean, what do you actually see that will end up happening and its consequences?
Well, I think, given what I was saying about the polling, I think unless Sadiq Khan is able to truly differentiate himself from the leadership, or rather can persuade the leadership to, in a sense, come round more to his point of view and say the things that he thinks are required to win over the voters that are required in the election, I think he could end up in a real double bind. I think he could end up in a situation where Sadiq Khan tries to differentiate himself from a leadership that he doesn't necessarily see fully eye to eye with on the basis of what he thinks needs to do, and then still loses because he's probably potentially still associated with an unpopular leadership in the capital. And I think the challenge for the Labour Party there is, I think various people have talked about, you know, these being the testbed and of Corbynism and so on. The reality is that if Sadiq Khan runs an independent campaign and loses, is that proof that Corbynism is the root of fault, or is it proof that actually you need to double down on Corbynism and do stuff? You know, the people that are in support of Corbyn don't trust the media and don't trust the polling. But will they even trust an election in terms of what it's trying to, the voters are trying to tell them about the party? So I think there's a real challenge there in sort of bear traps on both sides in terms of trying to use it as a testbed for anything.
And Acer, it'll be interesting what the Labour right does, because obviously you can't be seen as wanting Labour to do badly in a series of elections, but at the same time, probably privately, they might think that might be a good idea for the better long-term good of the party.
Of course. So for the meantime, they know they can't move against Corbyn now. They have to wait for these results. And so they want him to do well. Publicly, they want him to do very well. But the subtle tactic is they want him almost to do too well, in that the expectations are ridiculous for him. That Tristram Hunt was saying in Brighton that he has to win back London, he has to do very well in Scotland and in the local elections. And so what you're going to find is that if Sadiq doesn't win, then they're going to say, yeah, this is the curse of Corbyn. And yet, obviously, the left is very talented at dismissing any mishap by saying, well, we just need to double down and we're not fully Corbyn enough. So it's going to be interesting. It'll be a battle of spinning, basically.
And already, the Corbyn supporters will be able to point to policy issues where Jeremy Corbyn has had to temper his view, maybe on Triton and other things. So there's already, you can see the sort of formulation of some of those arguments, can't you?
Because they'll probably say that it's all the critics like Simon Danchuk and all the rest who've been sort of stabbing him in the back from day one, and as a result he's not been able to be his own man. Yet things like Trident, I would say, and no pun intended, would be a bit of an unexploded bomb for him, in that he's had to kind of kick it down the road.
Brighton
is a grown-up grown-up politics, of course, means that he didn't have to decide an answer. Yet in his cabinet there are people who passionately do not want to have Trident there, like Diane Abbott and fellow CND types. And yet there are those who, even his own shadow defence secretary saying that I am behind Trident, and Tom Watson saying that as well. So he's going to have to decide who he annoys. And this is where you might have shadow cabinet strife and all sorts of resignations on the cards.
I mean, final word to our guest, Acer. I mean, I suppose that the trouble the Tories might face or might not face at the moment is that almost overconfidence, you know, they feel that Labour is dead and buried. Do you think that that's just factually the case, and that they can proceed on that basis 10 more years and all the rest of it? Or do you think that there is any chance that Labour has, that the Tories might be sort of biting off more than they can chew, and actually Labour could come back?
I think it's factually the case, definitely. In that objectively, the facts are very much leaning in their favour, and they have a lot going for them. But they simply have to have this expectations game of just not letting the public know this, that they're enjoying themselves too much, because otherwise they won't look at the bear traps. Osborne will take his eye off the ball, and yet, obviously, they still have 5 years to finish in government, to actually show that they have this record of delivery. And so while it's kind of odds on, you'd think that they would stay on in government, and that people say Corbyn is the Tories' best recruiting sergeant.
Particularly because of the new boundaries as much as anything.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, everything sort of is coming up roses in a way. But they simply just have to sort of try and make it seem like they're not...
Dead roses.
Well, certainly, but not two red roses. It said blue roses, if you wish, for this picture of the electoral landscape. And obviously, when it comes to 2020, due to the... As we saw, 2015, they were relying on crude tactics to make sure Tory voters came out to back them, you know, saying, oh, Ed Miliband, you know, might have that scary Nicola Sturgeon to help him into office if you don't vote Tory. And so now he's going to have to try and make Corbyn seem like a threat. And so hence, that's why Michael Gove was going on, I believe it was the Mars show, saying Corbyn might well be Prime Minister. Ken Clark was saying much the same thing. It's because if you just ridicule him, then people will think that's fine, the Tories can walk it. But that's why they're going to have to build him up now. That's why there's all this thing about how, in Cameron's conference speech, he's a terrorist sympathising, Britain-hating, man, and this is why we can't let him anywhere near power. Because they want to make sure voters are terrified of this man, so that they actually make sure to vote Conservative and come out on election day.
And of course, the flip side to that in terms of the 2020 strategy, and a big, I think, underwritten probably this week in terms of the response to Cameron's speech, is that kind of liberal, cosmopolitan, you know, in favour of diversity and equality and so on, of course, is precisely the kind of pitch that they probably feel that the party needs in order to secure the seats that they won off the Lib Dems in 2015. If there's to be a Liberal Democrat resurgence and they lose those kind of middle class, small L liberal, fiscally perhaps somewhat conservative, voters who, in a sense voted, couldn't stand Clegg, voted, conservative this time, held their nose and so on. If they're to keep hold of those voters, then I would have thought that this, this kind of mood music of being progressive in a kind of, in a sense, is important to that. Because ultimately that's where the majority came from, right? It wasn't yes, they won a few seats off Labour, but fundamentally it was about winning, hoovering up Cornwall and places like that in terms of the changing parliamentary arithmetic.
So as Acer says, that fear message is still going to remain important, isn't it? Whether it's fear of the SNP or Labour or whoever. Acer and Robert, thanks very much.
That was Polling Matters in association with politicalbetting.com. Lots of interesting topics to discuss there. Obviously, as we know, as ever, there is lots to come in terms of the Conservative leadership change, EU referendums, and just what the Labour Party actually does and whether it learns to live with Jeremy Corbyn or not. And of course, the first tests of all of that feels like it will be next May, and we'll be talking about some of those elections in more detail in the coming weeks. Thanks for listening. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under Creative Commons.